This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Coming up, the financial toll from the natural disaster in Tonga will leave some businesses devastated for years to come. COVID-19's personal toll on a resident in Palau as the virus spreads further into the island nation. And as Australia's commercial importation of kava begins, questions around demand, supply and links to deforestation in the Pacific are cropping up. In Tonga, homes, villages and livelihoods have been left devastated by the volcanic eruption and tsunami. For some local businesses, the financial toll will be in the millions, but the full economic impact of the disaster remains unknown, as Marion Farr reports.
On the western coast of Tonga's main island, a resort is in ruins.
It's like a bomb hit this place, you know. It's like a war zone.
The once pristine beach is covered in ash. Trees are strewn across the ground and the resort's buildings have been flattened.
Everything, like it's a write-off, like it's there's nothing there.
Marion Tuku'afu is the co-owner of Vakaloa Beach Resort. Up until last week, the business was thriving.
Our venue was one of the biggest here in Tonga.
But now her livelihood has literally been washed away. A tsunami triggered by the Hungatonga-Hungaha'apai volcanic eruption wiped out the popular beachfront resort.
The truth is the damage is just phenomenal. Like, we've never seen anything like that.
Ms. Tuku'afu estimates the cost to rebuild will be about 3 million Tongan pa'anga, which is about 2 million Australian dollars. But it's not just her own family she's worried about. The resort and others in the area provide much-needed employment for locals.
Yeah, it's very sad. And along our coast, all the businesses are wiped out.
More than a week since the eruption, the full economic impact is still unknown. Images on social media show houses covered in ash, businesses damaged and farming land devastated. The World Bank is working with local authorities to assess the financial impact. But Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute says it's clear the cost will be substantial.
By comparison, cyclones in the region have been known to shave off, you know, up to 5% of a country's GDP if they're really badly struck. So, you know, Tonga and other Pacific nations are incredibly exposed to the economic shock of natural disasters. And, yeah, this is in a similar sort of category.
And Tonga's economy has already taken a hit with COVID-19.
They have been incredibly successful in keeping COVID out of the country and remaining one of the very few countries in the world that is COVID-free. But that's come at a huge cost to the economy. You know, it's killed tourism overnight and killed many other parts of the economy that are dependent on free movement of people in and out of the country.
Moving forward, Tonga will need help from international partners. The World Bank has provided $8 million in emergency relief and Australia has committed an initial $1 million with expectations of more funding to come. But Mr. Pryke says another big contributor will be remittances from overseas.
Remittances to Tonga are greater per year than the Australian aid inflows to Tonga. So it's a significant component of foreign exchange, of the economy and of just people's livelihoods and well-being.
There's already been an outpouring of financial support from Tongans around the world. But while families are eager to send money back home, accessing those funds is a challenge for people on the ground. A large undersea cable providing internet to Tonga was seriously damaged in the disaster, cutting off connectivity. While some services, including banking, are starting to come back online, it's likely to be weeks until the cable is repaired.
I'm sure it has led to a lag of these funds coming to the country.
While some businesses have been completely wiped out, others have jumped into action. Kennedy Penitani owns a bakery in Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa. On the Sunday after the eruption, he received a call from a government minister asking him to fire up the ovens and provide food for locals.
Sunday morning, I came downstairs and then I started the generator and the boys rocked up. And then we start baking.
Under Tongan law, shops are usually required to close on Sunday. But Mr. Penitani says this was a special exception.
So to me, I was glad. I was glad that I do my duty to feed the people and help out at this time of hardship.
Since then, the bakery has continued operating. But Mr. Penatani says getting ingredients could be a challenge.
If the shipment doesn't come in, it would be sausage or flour, and also other ingredients for making the bread.
But he's remaining positive about the future. And so is Marian Tugwafu.
I just said, you know, this is not the end of it. I know that there's something better. But we just pray that, you know, sooner or later, you know, we'll see what we're going to be doing. We've still got the heart to go on. Like they say, you know, we're mate ma Tonga, you know, we die for Tonga. So that's the heart that we have, really.
Marian Tukuafu ending that report by Marian Farr. COVID-19 cases in the Pacific are exploding. In the northern Pacific, Palau is facing a surge in cases as well. The country is battling its first coronavirus outbreak since the pandemic began. Our reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with Michelle, a resident in Palau, about how people are feeling on the ground.
Within our society now, in our community, there is a huge concern. As far as people, like, for example, for myself and for our organization, I've actually had to close out our office for 2 weeks just because the spread came so rapidly with the huge numbers and with the government trying to, you know, our healthcare system trying to monitor and maintain and do what they're supposed to be doing. It's a little overwhelming to my understanding in terms of our healthcare system. So everybody's basically following the news every day. There's like daily updates, so that's good on the part of our government with being transparent to the public. So some of the local, smaller local communities, they have put in place what we call a bul, B-U-L, and that means there's like no mass gatherings. There's like curfews. Children have to be home. So, and it comes from the high chief of that local community.
And so you're saying that you've had to close down your work for 2 weeks. Is that from the government or have you decided to do that?
No, us as a nonprofit organization, we made the decision for the safety of our staff and their loved ones, some of which have young kids, younger kids that are not at the age to be able to get the vaccination. For myself, I have an elderly mother. And especially for the children of our staff, we decided that it's best to close. We first closed down for the week, and then the second week came, and I'm like, okay, what do we do? And because it kept increasing the COVID cases, we decided let's go ahead and close again for another week just to see how things go.
And what's your sense of how the government is handling it at the moment? Like, do you trust that, you know, they're going to be able to see you through, or do you think that there are aspects in where they might need to pick it up a bit in order to keep everyone safe?
As far as the government is concerned, I think they are doing the best they can for what with the resources that they have now. I think they're doing a good job in communicating daily to the public, which is a great thing because that way the public is not in fear because, you know, fear causes chaos. So I think the government has done a great job in, especially with the COVID spread, with their communication and directions to the Republic, the people of the Republic of Palau. They started the community testing. Our hospital, our healthcare system actually opened this weekend, over the weekend, two days of where the people can come in to get tested if they feel that they may be asymptomatic or just people that want to make sure that they are not, they are COVID-free. So I think that was a plus.
And obviously you're kind of just at the start. You're about 2 weeks into dealing with an outbreak for the very first time. But as you said, over the past 2 years, I guess Palauans have been able to watch and see what's happened across the world. I guess what is your feeling just looking forward, knowing, I guess, how some other countries have dealt with it and seeing, I guess, other smaller Pacific Island countries as well, how they've managed it. I guess Fiji sort of had a big wave, but they managed to sort of get it under control. What's just your, feeling, I guess, looking ahead, just how you're feeling about, I guess, coming weeks?
Looking ahead into the future with COVID in Palau now, it's only been 2 weeks that we've actually had that outbreak. I think we should be able to overcome it, or at least it's here. and we can't say it's going to go away. But I think in the future, now that it's here, people are adapting to the new norm of, you know, their daily lives. And I think we will be okay. I mean, the world has lived with COVID except Palau for the past 2 years. We are now getting into it. So I think for us as Palauans, being a very small country, about, what, 20,000 people, I think we will be able to overcome by practicing and learning from the bigger countries and the other small neighboring countries of how they have adapted into living with the new normal.
A concerning time for Palau residents like Michelle, and she was speaking there to reporter Jordan Fennell. A trial of commercial kava imports into Australia is about to begin after an anxious delay for many producers. At least two companies have been granted permits to start the process, but hundreds of kava growers in Fiji are still waiting to get their foot in the door. While other importers and exporters are struggling to meet Australian requirements, and as Mackenzie Smith reports, there's concern that unless regulations are improved, the new market could worsen the ongoing problem of deforestation in the Pacific.
Since Australia's long-awaited reopening of commercial kava imports in December, there's been a flood of interest from prospective importers and exporters. It's hoped the supplies will help lower kava prices for Australia's Pacific community, which struggled when the drink was only able to be brought in small quantities for personal use. But for many kava farmers in the Pacific, that's easier said than done. Alifereti Tawaki helps run the Kandavu Kava Farmers Association in Fiji, which has around 300 members. He says they're keen to get on board with exporting to Australia, but only for the right price.
If the demand from Australia comes with the return that they need, then it'll be, that's a big help for them. Right now, I heard what they are advising each other, the farmers in Kandavu at least, is hold on to your cover plants until the prices are right.
Mr. Tawaki says local kava farmers haven't seen much progress with profits from export markets, where they have little negotiation power. Right now, he says export sales are also roughly the same as local prices, leaving little incentive for them to make the switch. That hasn't stopped Fiji's Green Gold Kava, which was able to send 700 kilograms of its products to Australia this month, according to Australia's ambassador to Fiji, John Feeks. And after becoming one of the first to secure an import permit, another company, Fiji Kava, says its products are expected to hit Australian supermarket shelves this month. Where larger companies are making headway, though, Alifereti Tawaki says smaller exporters are struggling to meet export requirements.
There are some biosecurity requirements that have to be met. We have a packing shed ensured to be able to meet some of the standards and requirements before we apply for the export permit from this site. And then after that, we have to find somebody with an import business with an import permit from Australian side.
And he says getting the details right is crucial for the farmers.
It's very, very important for the farmers. They're able to pay for their kids to school, able to improve their livelihoods, even build their houses. So the industry is quite critical for most of the cover farming communities, which are probably nationwide in Fiji.
Richard Markham is a cocoa grower in Fiji and adjunct professor in sustainable development at the University of the Sunshine Coast. He's worried a kava boom could worsen environmental concerns in an already troubled industry.
It's only when it becomes commercial that the sort of cascade of environmental effects tends to take off. And price goes up, then people are looking for bigger tracts of land, and that's when they're going out and clearing rainforests in search of fertile soil. You know, the kava needs fertile soil, and the easiest way to arrange for that is to burn some forests, which releases the nutrients, and you get a decent crop of kava.
Those concerns are also being raised in Vanuatu, where the opposition leader Ralph Reagan-Vanu says new kava plantations are the leading cause of deforestation. Dr. Markham says Australia has a responsibility to help farmers in the Pacific adopt more sustainable farming practices.
It would probably still be unwise to plant kava and then kava again and then kava again, but there's no reason why you shouldn't grow kava and then grow a kind of rotation of beans or some ginger or something like that, and then rotate back to kava rather than just abandoning the land and waiting for bush fallow to restore it.
Australia's kava imports trial will run until the end of 2023, when the government will decide whether to legislate the policy.
That was Mackenzie Smith reporting. Preserving traditional knowledge can be difficult and it can be so easily lost over time. But a book published in Fiji hopes to preserve some of that knowledge and highlight the importance of Indigenous healing plants and healing methods. Its author has spent years collating the information. Suliana Sowatibo is a renowned botanist in Fiji. She's been a researcher, a teacher, worked for the government, but her latest project took a lot of time and a lot of notes.
My interest is in plants. I started off as a plant breeder at the agriculture department in Fiji and then went across to the university after a few years. And that's where I developed an interest in traditional medicine.
Her newest book, Healing Plants of Fiji, is a collection of traditional herbal medicines and knowledge that has been used in Fiji for hundreds of years. She worked with university students and collated information from at least 82 different healers across the country.
We decided then to engage some students and applied for funding so the students could go around Fiji and collect information before it died.
Some of the knowledge in the book has been passed down through many generations of traditional Tauki healers. The book also documents scientific information on herbal medicines, including plants that are used to treat high blood pressure along with other ailments.
The other reason that I thought this would be useful is for people to develop pills, because as long as you use only plants, the use of these plants is limited, but if you begin to develop other things like tinctures and pills and so on, you can widen the use of these plants.
While methods are preserved by various healers and their families, there's a growing concern that traditional medicine and knowledge will be lost and that younger generations won't be able to access it, including Ms. Suwatibao's great-niece.
So I call her Bumbusuli, that means like grandmom. And I know that this has always been her passion. She has a huge garden and she's always gone and taken us through it.
Kale Senilole grew up around her great aunt's love of plants and understands the importance of preserving the knowledge.
So I feel like the fact that everything that she's learned over the years, I think she's really glad that she's made it materialized everything for everyone else. So I'm quite glad that she's able to share her knowledge to everybody.
Ms. Senilole hopes that by publishing a book like this will inspire more Fijian elders to document their knowledge so it won't be lost time.
The way that people reacted to the book being published, like people were so excited. So I really do hope that it pushes for other elderly people, maybe their families, to go and reach out to the elderly, to just gather knowledge, yes.
For Suliana Sumwadibao, she wants to see traditional healing knowledge work hand-in-hand with Western medicine.
I'm hoping that people who are involved in, first of all, healing people here in Fiji will gain more confidence, and that medical institution will be able to help them identify why their healing plants work, and therefore will be able to like develop a little bit of the use of medicinal plants for healing in Fiji.
That was botanist Suliana Sowatibao ending that report. The search has begun at Cricket Vanuatu for a new high-performance manager after former Ireland international player Jeremy Bray resigned. He was just 11 months into his three-year contract but decided to step down for personal and pandemic reasons. Bray may not have been in the country for long, but he certainly left his mark, not least with a decision to create combined male and female training sessions for the leading players. It's an innovation that Cricket Vanuatu is keen to build on, so as Richard Hewitt reports, whoever takes up the reins will need to be prepared for that challenge.
It was a short but sweet relationship, and Cricket Vanuatu's chief executive Tim Cutler says Jeremy Bray's influence on the country's best male and female players has been profound.
The beauty of Vanuatu, you've got all this untapped natural talent, but on the flip side, a lot of this talent has not necessarily been coached in the basics that you may see in a larger system. So there's also teaching some basics throughout that squad that maybe they just haven't picked up over the years. And the way he was able to work with every single player, I could see the look on their faces when I said that he was not going to continue in the role. There was a definite glum look on most faces.
However, that disappointment might be offset by Jeremy Bray's legacy, which Tim Cutler says includes mixed training sessions, which have proved highly popular with the players.
He said, well, rather than me spreading myself too thin across both squads and trying to be everything to everyone, why don't we integrate the women into the men's squad? So, but it was one of those sort of light bulb moments. It's like, oh, geez, why didn't we think of this before? So four professional women's players integrated in, and we're training full-time all the time with the men's, and they've seen great improvements.
The women's national captain, Selena Solomon, admits she took a little bit of convincing at first.
At the start, I was like, oh, no, I don't even know. I think he's just trying to punish us. But then I came to realize that he was just trying to push us to get us better. It was really, really intense training, very good training. I think a lot of people saw the difference. You get to see the game from both sides. The boys were strong, but I think they pushed us. They always encouraged us to do our best. So I think it's a really good idea for the men and women to train together.
Training with the men meant Solomon and her teammates found themselves batting against the fastest of the male bowlers. The captain doesn't deny she was a little scared at first, but it wasn't long before she came to relish the challenge.
I think I missed half of the ball, but then when I started hitting the ball, I was just looking forward. I was like, okay, bring it on. You know, I wanted to try more. It was good. I was nervous, but then I got a hold of it. It was scary, but exciting at the same time.
There was always a rule that one of the women players had to open the batting and or one had to open the bowling to make sure that they were getting most out of it. I think it really brought a new element for the boys. There was an element of scared getting out, but also this different pace on the ball and different strategies. But also from the women's point of view, facing balls that were being bowled to them faster than they had before sort of brought them up to a new level. So no, they were very much part of it. And I think it goes to the culture of the Vanuatu people. There was a real sort of no-fear approach to this.
So could the mixed training format be replicated elsewhere? Tim Cutler thinks it could, even to the extent of some formally organised mixed matches.
These players are all friends and all family and all get on really well. The integration was amazing. So I think you'd have to work through all of that, but I'd be absolutely recommending it. It is great to see that nobody really raises an eyebrow. You say it to someone, they go, oh, yeah, that makes sense to them, and everybody gets on with it. So looking at something more formal, there's a kernel there, definitely, that something could be worked with in the future.
The mixed training will certainly put Selena Solomon in good stead after she was called up yet again to take part in the Fairbreak Invitational event, which this year is being hosted by Dubai. The privately funded tournament brings together players from around the world to compete and also to advocate for gender equality.
For me, I never thought I could play in the same team with, you know, Alex Blackwell and Australian, New Zealand players growing up, watching them. And we really have a small chance of making World Cup, and playing with those people was, you know, it was just a dream. But for me, like, Fairbreak has given me that chance to actually play and be part of a game with them.
But despite being a Fairbreak regular and having been voted a player of the match in the past, Solomon is still a little in awe of the company in which she finds herself.
Honestly, I have to say, I'm still nervous knowing that we're going to be bigger and better. Most of the coaches always tell me, my coaches said, you train hard, you play hard, and just give it all, because I know that I'm not only representing myself, I'm representing everyone back here. So I'm just going to go there, give it all, and do my best.
Meanwhile, the search for a new high-performance director goes on, and Tim Cutler is expecting no shortage of applications, with inquiries already coming in from England and India, for example. But whoever gets the nod from Cricket Vanuatu will have to be someone who is prepared to follow Jeremy Bray's lead and go with the programme.
There absolutely will be an element of that. And by no means would I want to go through a process of telling an applicant what to do. I think it will be somewhere in the middle of talking about the things that have worked well and being really open about the challenges that comes with moving to and living in Vanuatu and how they can probably best build from whatever's been done before. It's a matter of looking at these things the best way possible. It's how we build on what's been done. If there's ways to adapt even further than what has occurred, it's going to be a real positive process where we're in a good place.
Cricket Vanuatu's Chief Executive Tim Cutler ending that report from Richard Ewart. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.